seasonal for us.
Well,
we had a sprinkling of snow just earlier. It's been kind of cold and rainy ever since.
We had a tough winter last year, and this year we just had one snow in October, and nothing, not a flake of snow I've seen since October.
Yeah, you've had pretty mild winter for you all, haven't
you? Yeah, I've never remembered it my whole life been like this. We've always had some snow.
Yeah.
So I hope this doesn't mean that we're gonna have like a summer that's 150 degrees.
Yeah, it'd be nice not to have that.
I'll take it as it comes. This week looks nice, so. Today looks good. I like living in the moment.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot to be said for that. To really, in terms of enjoyment in life, I think a lot of people miss it because they're looking for the next thing. And they can have a the day itself, there's so much they can do. I mean, you're really living in the moment anyway. Reality is not anything except for what's, your current experience. I think with the Kohelet talks about accomplishment and where people are looking to. So the attitudes, the natural dispositions and emotions, they propel a person to be always thinking I think fewer people harp on past, either good old times or they think about the negative. Everybody has their very unique set of emotions and experiences that mold them. But I think a lot more people are looking into the looking for the next thing, I guess, for the sense of accomplishment, or their current life is just not exciting enough, so they build up what might be the next big thing.
The day for us has been very exciting. It's my 7-year anniversary, and one of our daughters just lost one of her first bugs, and she broke out a couple of years ago, but her first natural is coming out. Very exciting day.
Wow. Milestones.
Congratulations, Jim.
Happy anniversary.
Oh, and my wife is getting promoted, too. Everything's coming up roses today.
Great.
Hey.
I see. Do you know where we left off the last time we got together? I know it was 2 weeks ago.
My impression was we had finished Kohelet, and then we were just going to go back and see if there was anything we wanted to pick up.
Right. So we're going to do like review. I did, just looking this morning at the very beginning, and you see how, when he sets the theme down, something which we saw throughout, but now looking after going through the whole book and going to the beginning, you see that he talks about that everything is futile, the first few verses. Chapter 1, verse 2, everything is futile. And he says in 3, what benefit is there, what extra is there to man, but all his work that he labors under the sun. So you see the tone where he sets that right away, that, is the sound okay from here?
Yeah.
Okay. So he sets the tone about his critique being all that which is under the sun. So if you don't pick it up right away, he makes sure that you get it later on, because how numerous times, a countless number of times in the book, he kept on talking about under the sun when he was critiquing, because he's telling you where a person's disposition is trying to assess happiness. Where is it going to acquire? So he says, if you're looking for it under the sun, so then what benefit can you really get? And Sforno, on the spot there, says that being that man is a tselem elokim, that he has intelligence, so what is going to be that which he is, what's going to benefit him from anything which is really transient, anything which comes and goes? So those things are really transient. And that really can't benefit the eternal part of man. It's the sworn of Sesta there. It's on 1-3. But he really sets the tone. You see how King Solomon sets the tone right in the beginning. And not only that, he qualifies it in the next verse when he says, a generation comes and a generation goes, but the world stands eternally. So you have to ask why he's bringing that up. But there, now we understand. He's combating the drive for immortality, which is also another major theme that he was addressing. And that's really like the underpinning, the substratum for, you know, many, if not most, of man's mistakes. Everything he goes after in terms of his attempts to get fulfilled, to be satisfied, so that's predicated on a false view that he's never leaving Earth. And that's why you have people like, you know, the Hearst would make this big castle that, like Reverend Chait mentioned once, you know, outlives by, you know, hundreds of years, it outlives the person who built it. So that image, you know, the person builds this great, you know, luxurious house that's going to stand for a millennium, and he's leaving in a few decades. So right at the beginning of his book, he goes right to the most primary emotions. Okay. Now, let me also leave it up to you, too, if there were any things that you guys had seen that you just wanted clarification or, you know, in retrospect as we're going through this. So you let me know if there's any specific points or issues. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Doug. He's not saying that nothing here is of value. It can't be, because God created us to have this experience on Earth. So there has to be a very important reason for our existence here for all these years, all these many decades. When he critiques this world, he's saying if a person uses it as an ends in itself. Rabbi Chait explained that there was a big question that the rabbis had on King Solomon. That God said after the creation of every day in Genesis that it was good. And Koheleth says that the world is futile. So they said, how could you say that when God said it was good? So the answer is that Koheleth is talking about if a person chases after the physical as an end, not as a means for his perfection of a soul, for his eternal life. So the existence and all the wisdom that God embedded in all of creation, we have a statement that we say many times, you know, throughout the week, that the whole world is full of God's glory. That means that he created the world with an imprint of his wisdom. So this way, anywhere a man turns, he's impressed with this. And that's really for man's good. And that pursuit is something which is the most fulfilling. And like you said, it's nothing additional. I mean, what it said about the rabbis, that they anticipated the next world, it was because it was a situation which was a higher degree of what they learned to really value here. It wasn't something additional, like a separate, like a reward case. You know, you do X, I'll give you Y. That can't apply to the Torah. That implies that the Torah is not the best thing. Because if I'm doing the Torah, then I'm going to get something else as a reward. So that means the reward is better. And that mitigates the significance of Torah. So it can't be that way. It's not what it means by reward. It means the continued existence of the soul at a higher level. But it's a continuation of what it was pursuing. The soul will exist if it partook of wisdom and it really enjoyed. I mean, you see, that's what Moses asked God. He's in conversation after God forgave the Jews for the golden calf. We just read it last week. And he saw that it was an opportune time, as Rashi says. So he said, God's forgiving, and he's answering positively to my requests. So Moses said, please show me your unique nature. He asked God for that, because that's what he was really curious about. That's what his real drive was. It was not for wealth, not for fame, not for longevity. He had this opportunity speaking to the creator of the universe, and the one thing he asked was to understand more, to understand him. So that's really the paradigm of the person who's seen as much as, you know, a person like Moses has seen, and look what he's interested in. The more he sees, the more he is enveloped by this rapture, this harmony of the universe, this orchestra of perfected natural laws that you see, evidenced in people like Einstein, Newton. There are a few individuals, but they represent the species. It's just that most people are going against what King Solomon was teaching. And they are going after the fantasy and immortality and accomplishment and building and fame and wealth. But if those few individuals that were able to get a taste of wisdom and really immerse themselves in it, and they saw new insights, that really lit their souls up in a way that nothing else could. And they saw past things that were temporary. That's hard for a person, evidently. A person can't let go of that immortality fantasy, so that's really the foundation for his thrusting himself into all these other areas. It's because he really believes he's not leaving. That's why he can invest so much energy into here and now, and the big house, and the fame, and everything which is truly transient, but he doesn't really believe that. But if a person does get to that realization, if he can mature, so that will help loosen the grip on those things he's chasing after and be concerned more with what's real, what is eternal. So the real pursuit is the wisdom. That is. And that is here and in the next world, because that is the absolute. You wonder how I was talking to my friend's child yesterday, and just trying to enlighten him. He's very young, but I wanted to see his reaction too. I was curious if I said to him, can I make an elephant appear just by saying I wish it to appear? And I'm pointing like to a space in the kitchen where we're sitting. So he says, of course not. And what about a giraffe? What about anything? He goes, no. But I said, but that's exactly what God did. And that itself is like an amazing thing, that just by will alone, the Creator was able to bring into existence universes, galaxies, the expanse, we can't even measure it. It's just amazing. And all the laws, imagine you're talking about things like, you know, a black hole, some place in the universe the gravity is so intense that even light doesn't escape. I mean, the fact that light is affected by gravity is an amazing thing. But it's tough, you know, the world we live in, the society we're in, does not promote this type of thinking. It's just the opposite. But that's what King Solomon did. I mean, you see, he went through and he talked about amassing wealth and fame. And he had more than anybody else. When he makes a statement that he had more than anybody else that was before him, so that's a statement of comparison. And that can only be expressed in the context of somebody who understands a certain span of history. And then you can talk about fame. Fame is a relative thing. You're famous relative to who? All right. All right. I mean, we had mentioned also, it was important how Rabbi Chait, when he initially gave these classes a few decades ago, how he discussed the parallel, the metaphor of the sun shining and moving forth in verse 5, that the reason why a person is looking for accomplishment and all this is because there's a libido in man, there's a drive. And this is a reference to that. That there's a desire, as Ibn Ezra says, that the sun desires to shine forth. And he spoke in 6 about how it moves to certain locations, and he brings in a new thing. It goes to the north, and to the, it circles around, to the south, and to the north, meaning a person is looking in life for the next thing. So a location means he's arriving at a new situation, a new position, a new point in life. Because that's where the energies will push a person. And verse 7, of course, is a famous verse where it talks about all the rivers that go to the sea, and but the sea doesn't get full. So Rabbi Chait explained that to me, and again, that the energies are constant. They're flowing. They're always moving forward. That's natural in a person, and it doesn't stop. Sometimes a person can get frustrated. The energy is still there, but in a person, you know, many people, they can experience a frustration, and they it doesn't mean the energy is not there to be successful, but there's certain emotions that would have to be worked out. All right, I'm not going to do every verse. Simply because I don't have every answer. I try to recall as we go along. And again, if there's specific things, we can take a minute here if you want to just look through. If you have certain things, it doesn't have to be in order either. But if there are like specific points, I know it's maybe asking a bit because, you know, we're calling back, you know, a few years of doing this. But maybe there's certain points or certain questions in general that either that he brought up or that, you know, are still lingering in our minds that we can, you know, discuss now.
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal.
One area in Kohelis to me is chapter 3 when he talks about a time to be born and all of that. Timing is so important, and it's so paramount to recognizing the passage of that, and yet God doesn't live in the realm of time. And my mind seems to kind of go back and forth between what that means, what kind of a dimension that is, and how time is so significant for us, and in a way it's created that way, I guess. It's just more of a pondering thing than actually, you know, having questions or whatever. I just find my mind spins around on that a lot.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, God, like Maimonides says, God created time. So, of course, he's not existing in a state where there's any change. I mean, something which we don't understand. That was exactly what Moses wanted to know. And he said, God said, listen, you can't know me while you're alive. That knowledge you can't have. The reason being because all human knowledge depends on it being connected to something physical. We can't think of anything that's not, you know, not connected to the physical. It's just the way we are. All of our senses are physical, and that's where knowledge begins. So anything you can imagine, anything you can think of, is going to be related somehow to physical, and therefore there can't be any concept we can have of God. So all we could say is that he's not within time, he's not controlled by his creations, time being his creation. But we do. Why he created it this way, I don't know. But we see that it is very necessary, because if there isn't time, that means everything is frozen in a certain state without motion, without the ability to age, without to progress, to learn. Because without time, there's no subsequent points. And that's necessary in terms of learning. So in his wisdom, he saw that to create a timeline, to create the entity of time, meaning a framework in which there can be change in this physical world that he's going to create. So now things can grow and die. Things can mature. Things can relate to each other. They can interact. So that's the essential backdrop to everything else. Now, in terms of what King Solomon was saying, in terms of there's a time for this and time for that, so we discussed that he was trying to make a primary point, and that is he was speaking to man's insecurity, which is also, again, another giant theme in Koheles. You know, happiness, but happiness many times is tied to man's need to be secure. So what does man do in order to try to be secure? He tries to look at something, some event, some object, some attitude, some feeling that he can rely on and say, yeah, this is always going to be a safe, this is always home, this is always going to be a good. Always is the key word here. That's the operational word here. So what King Solomon understood with his great wisdom is that a person clearly, simply, you know, we don't need great wisdom to see that people want to be happy, but he understood man's psyche, and he sees how man works, and he wanted to expose that to us and show you that you're looking for happiness in something, in war, in love, in dancing, in singing. No, there's a time and place for that. Sometimes there's a time for dancing, sometimes there's a time for mourning. And he goes through all those attitudes there to show a person that there is no one attitude that is always going to give you your satisfaction. Don't look for these things in terms of being, you know, affording you your happiness. It's not an attitude. Of course, it'll leave you with one big question. That question being, so what is it that will give a person happiness? But before he does that, he has to strip down the wrong ideas. So that's a major idea. That's what he says in the beginning of chapter 3, the first verse. He says, to every time and moment, to every desire, he says, there is a time and moment to every desire under the sun. A time for birth, a time for death. And he goes, time for killing and time for healing, because he's trying to remove a person from the position that certain things are always good. But that's because, again, a person is looking to have some security of where he could always derive his happiness from. But that's not proper. The proper approach is what? You tell me.
I was finding my mind wandering a bit and wondering if there was a concept of time when Adam and Eve were in the garden. If that we have evidence that there was, because there was no death then.
So what were you wondering about?
Whether time was apparent then, or if it came into being once man became mortal.
No, there had to be time. The first moment God created the physical. Because in order that, from that physical object, the Rabbi Ramban, Nachmanides, he says the first thing which God created was as small as a mustard seed. I don't know why, but he's saying that the first instant of creation, there was a tremendous amount of mass, but it was very small, and from that it had developed. What's the Darwinian term they use? Evolved. Evolved, the God created it, but there was change. So as soon as you have change in the physical, that requires time. So time was there from the first moment of creation. You can't have transition from one state of being to another without time. So as soon as the first physical substance came into existence and it started to change, so that moment that it started to change, time was introduced. It had to be. Otherwise, you have no framework where it could move. Imagine taking clay and jamming it into a jar to the top and then sealing the jar. So the clay can't conform to any new shape because it's now restricted by the jar. So the jar, in that case, is time. But if we take that clay and we put it into a jar that's a million times bigger than itself, now it's got the ability to start settling down, and to flatten out, and to change. Because now it has a framework of time to move in.
I've often thought that if Adam and Eve hadn't had the sin and man continued to exist in that way, there's no controls for population or anything, and I've wondered if somewhere down the chain the sin would have inevitably happened.
The sin would inevitably have happened.
Inevitably, yeah. Like, man's natural curiosity about things, if it would have happened, maybe not with Adam and Eve, but in the children.
Well, certainly, because they were created most perfected. You have to keep in mind that, like Ibn Ezra says, he says Adam was a great intellect. God made him perfect, mature, with a perfect mind. But God is showing us at the very outset that it's impossible that making the person this way that they won't slip up. Meaning it was not necessary at the outset to make the emotion of the conscience, of guilt. That's why they were naked and they weren't embarrassed. Because they didn't have morality. They were only involved in the world of true and false, of wisdom. And that would be the highest level to exist. But since they did have emotions, so what happened was that they inevitably sinned. So God is teaching us that this is the best design that there could be, and even with that best design, there still is going to be a certain problem. And therefore, he illustrates that right at the beginning of the book of Genesis to teach us the workings of man. I believe that that's what King Solomon was doing here as well. He's teaching us about the psyche, the ego, the libido, the drive for accomplishment. He's telling all these different factors. He's telling us at the beginning of the book so we understand all of his principles subsequent to that. So I believe God's doing the same thing when he talks about Adam and Eve, and he gives us a great detail and about man's workings right in the beginning, so we can see, oh, this is man's nature, this is inevitable based on the design. Of course, people start asking questions, well, why didn't God make man in a different way? That we can't ask. To know God's mind, that's impossible. That's like, you know, again, Moses' question. But based on this, which we accept is the best design, there's still going to be certain, when you give man emotions and you give him free will, so once you give free will, that is not coming from God anymore. So then you're not a perfect being. And that's why he says here in this book, that there's no man who is righteous on earth that does good but never sins. It's just like you're saying, Cal, it's inevitable. But not even down the line, meaning the very first, most perfected beings. You see, getting back to your first point, Cal, so this point about there's a time and place for everything, it means that don't look for your security in a certain one area. I'm always going to be giddy. I'm always going to be looking for love or whatever it is, whatever the attitude is. That has to be under the guidance of wisdom. Wisdom is really going to be how you're going to guide your life to happiness. Don't look for security in a certain attitude, because at times you have to change. You don't look for peace all the time. Sometimes you have to fight. The person who thinks that peace is an absolute good is a fool. He's going to try to make peace with somebody who's going to kill him. So that wisdom has to really be what guides you to answer the question that I asked before. You see, he talks about this in this chapter 3, because this is a very, you know, strong desire. And it's true. I mean, a person does want to have security. But you see what King David did when he was found himself amongst his enemies. And he said, I have to act like a drooling fool right now in order that they don't think that I'm King David. Then they'll kill me. So that's exactly what happened. He walked around like he was demented and drooling, saliva was going down his beard, and some people say, well, the king that was after King David's life at that point, this is David, this can't be King David. So it worked. He used his intelligence and to protect his life at that point. Now is the time I don't have dignity. He completely abandoned the need for dignity in order to save his life. If that's where a person wants security, that's where you put your security. You do your best in terms of your intelligence, in your mechanical strengths that we have, muscular strength, the technology, ingenuity, and of course, we pray to God to give us the assistance. That paradigm example of Jacob being chased after his twin, Esav. So he prayed to God, and he prepared a gift, and he prepared for war. He covered all bases. Military, if it comes down to that. Politically, he sent them gifts to try to bribe his heart. And he prayed. That's the right approach. But you see, people do get, why do people get attached to a specific? Oh, I'm going to be peaceful all the time. People have movements. The problem with the movement is that they're not following King Solomon's advice. Sometimes your movements, the mission statement of your movement, you can't follow because, like King Solomon says, there's a time for everything, and sometimes you can't be peaceful. So for a person or a group to have a mission statement, unless the mission statement is, we're always going to follow reason. That's the one mission statement that will be, it'll survive all situations. In all conditions. That doesn't mean you're going to be successful either, but that's the best approach that you have. But that also has to be based on knowledge. Meaning, wisdom is based on understanding all the factors. So that's what King Solomon is doing with us. He's sharing with us all the different factors of the human personality, the human condition, the aspirations. And the overwhelming one is that the person is so anchored in the physical, he doesn't think he's leaving here. So his immortality fantasy drives him to activities in life that he'll spend decades at until he wakes up when he's 85 years old and says, what did I do working to build this gigantic empire that I'm not taking it with me? I should have spent my time more with my family, perfecting my my morality, understanding more about God. So King Solomon did all this as a great kindness to humanity. So listen, I've had everything at all the resources. I was king in Jerusalem. We were at the height of civilization, of intelligence, and people who came to us, like he quotes the Queen of Sheba, and she says after she heard King Solomon's wisdom, the great wisdom that I heard about you, now that I hear it and I'm in person, it wasn't half of how great you really are. So you see that the history, you know, it testifies to the greatness of the Jewish nation at that era and their wisdom. And with all that, King Solomon said, now I'm going to examine and use myself as an example and explore every single aspect, whether it's having people underneath me, all of the maid servants and men servants and wealth and silver and gold. They said in King Solomon's time, silver was considered nothing back then. It was like a worthless item because gold was so abundant and the riches that he had were so amazing. But people don't take less. I mean, here's a person who miraculously got wisdom at 12 years old from God, and he's sharing with us his discoveries as he experimented on himself and he explored and he showed all the different nuances in the personality, and yet people beg to differ. Because they're too blinded. They're too blinded by competition. Another big emotion. The social arena. I believe that's at the root, really, of the desire, certainly for fame, because fame means I am different than others. But wealth, too. Wealth is a relative term. I'm wealthy compared to somebody else who has less. So the person who lives this life is in tremendous competition. He's just trying to beat out and show other people, look, I have more, but he's never explored whether that's going to give him happiness. But he's blinded by what everybody else is doing. So competition in the social realm, I mean, a person is social. Somebody told me recently that Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, he defined a person as a social being. So the need to be in community, of course, is a good. God created that need. But people abuse that, and they start becoming, social becomes like an end in itself. And they can't uproot themselves from that need for the applause, which is truly only in their own imagination. Because they have no idea about what people are thinking about them in reality. So they do things, and they spend time in life, a tremendous amount of energy based on what they feel people will be thinking about them. That's an amazing thing. And there's no validation of that, but a person will spend so much time. If a person would realize that, and they would be able to, 90% of their time, they'd be able to put into themselves. Instead, they're living for somebody else. It's a real shame. Yep.
Rabbi, that's interesting. So what is the proper end of the social?
Again, a little louder, Jim.
Yeah, I'm sorry. What is the proper end of the social life?
You're asking what is the proper attitude towards the social life?
Yeah, what is the desired end?
What is the desired end, you said? Okay. I mean, what is the objective in God creating human beings as social individuals?
Yes, he said that some people treat it as an end in itself, and that just begs the question for me, so what's the proper end?
Right. Well, the proper end, this multifaceted. First of all, of course, there's the person can't procure, the rabbis talk about, the person, an individual living alone, can't procure all of his needs to survive on his own. I mean, if it was up to a person, then he'd have to build his own house, create his own plumbing, make his own clothing, plant and harvest the fields. It would be just too much work for one person. So, by the fact that you have communities, so, first of all, primarily, God wants the good. So his act of creating a human being, we don't, again, God doesn't work in motivation. Motivation is a human phenomenon. So we can't ask, why did God do something? That's like saying, well, he had a motive to do it. So you have to be careful. So we can't ask why he did it. All we could know is that he did create human beings, and he created them in a way to have a tremendous benefit. So that's a real act of chesed. Chesed meaning kindness. And the kindness is multiplied by the fact that he created billions of people. So now we understand that, number one, he gives his goodness in an abundant way. And that's what he said to Moses. He said, Rav Chesed, I'm abundant in kindness. So that's one thing. So there should be many recipients of God's good. Not just one. Of course, we can see that clearly. It's much greater good if there's billions of people that have the potential for a great existence and an eternal happiness than if only one person had it. Number two, we see practically that in the community, and again, God designed us in a way where the social will complement community life if, you know, approached properly. So it creates good feelings. And, you know, the need for social and the attachments, the emotional way, you know, the design of the emotions that we become attached to people that we're more familiar with and we see longer periods of time, we start to grow an attachment to them. It's a natural thing. And that's for the good of their good, our good, the good of the community. And the good social, you see that there's a greater lean towards kindness than there is towards crime. So that's why the majority of the world is they work together for their community. They may have opposition to other communities, they may oppose other communities, but within their group, you see that they have a code. They have a certain way they live. They don't hurt each other. So that's good for promoting, you know, continued life and new generations. So there's many elements to how the social and the various emotions that come under that big umbrella, what the benefits are. But just, you know, we can see a broad few strokes over there. I mean, you can go into more specifics about, you know, well, within social, then you have the emotional need for their approval. You know, they have ego. So you see God designed man with that, self-esteem, that's necessary for development, that person's confidence in order that they can move forward. A person that has low esteem can't. They don't think they can accomplish something, so they don't try. And they end up not being able to procure the basic needs. I mean, you have the emotion of fame also, which is, you know, part of the ego. So maybe at a certain point in life, that's a good motivator. And I think Maimonides actually says that when you start raising your child, so you get them to start, you know, learning. So when they're younger, you give them candy. When they get older, you give them something else that's more dignified. And then when they're maybe in their teens, you tell them, learn so you could become like this great rabbi. Then you bring ego into the picture. So at different moments, just like King Solomon said in chapter 3, time and place for everything. So at a certain point in development and in, you know, your tutelage of your children and your students, so the ego is something which you use, and you use that you harness that emotion in people intelligently, but always for their own good. Always for their own good. It gets to a point where a person has to get past that. And he's not doing it for the ego anymore. And we did that one Ibn Ezra, in one commentary here, where he talks about the development and how a person develops and how he teams up the sense of ego and accomplishment and until he finally is doing things for the true reason, which is, you know, the perfected level, where a person is doing something because he sees that that's the good, that's the truth. And he cares about others equal to himself, and which of course is the highest level, where he's not the center anymore. But it's interesting, you see, you know, I wondered why, you know, people ask, why didn't God just, you know, by the plagues, the 10 plagues? So God could have done this without Moses. That we agree.
Agree.
So we wonder what role really was it that Moses had to approach Paro. So I think it's because it was to represent an idea to Paro that it's the person who lives with intelligence that God will now be close to him in his life, and even miracles will be, you know, wrought on behalf of that person and his people. So God was trying to extricate the Egyptians from their mentality, where it was just following imagination. And he presented Moses to them, who was an intelligent person, and gave insight to the plagues. It wasn't just that the plagues came and hit them, he gave them insight. He said, look, you're being obstinate, and you're going to break, just like when the hail came down and broke the stiff plants. But if you're not obstinate, and you start to relinquish a bit, and you're softer, so you'll survive, just like the hail didn't damage the unripe crops that were still flexible and still soft. So you see that in that realm, the social was necessary in terms of understanding how others who are an example are necessary for my own edification. God wanted Paro and the Egyptians to see what the primary existence of man should be. So sure, God could have come in and taken care of the miracles by himself without Moses' involvement. But then that would have forfeited the lesson that the Egyptians would be able to see an intelligent person in contrast to themselves. So it's another benefit of the social arena. Again, there's many, many examples, many lessons. But that seems to be the whole principle why there's such a thing as prophets. Another primary, you know, you're touching on a very primary point here. You know, sometimes you have points in the Torah that, you know, how do you do this mitzvah, or a certain point of philosophy. But now what we're touching on here is, what's the whole structure of the system that God gave to man that there's prophecy? And that, you see, Maimonides says it's one of the 13 principles, that God gives prophecy to man. So it's not just for the prophet, but now the prophet now represents to the rest of the world how they should be living. And it's only through intelligence that you reach a level that God actually communicates with you. And then he gives you even more intelligence. I mean, because you achieve this and you worked on your own, so now God relates to you and gives you even more information. And then you become a prophet. And again, that helps mankind too. That new information that the prophet receives he shares that with man. But again, it's God trying to help all of humanity by setting up an individual that can be an example, and it illustrates to the person, look, that's the person who really is living the best. That's the person who, and he's again, you know, you see that. I think it was Maimonides or Sadigon, I think the aside you go in, actually, that you see the prophets, however, were not protected with any type of from death. You see, certain prophets were killed, they murdered. So you shouldn't think that they were living this life because this gave them certain good physical benefits. It should be clear that they lived that life regardless of what might happen, but in their life itself, regardless of how it ended, because the end is only physical. But in their life, they lived this way because it was the good. Not because it secured them from mishap. I mean, it's true that you have general rules that a person lives properly. So then, there's greater providence. But interesting statement by Sadie Gone, though, that they weren't. Again, you'd have to say in those cases, though, there was some reason. There had to be some reason why negative things happened. Because King David said clearly, and David said, King David said it through divine inspiration, that a person is completely righteous, so a number of mishaps may about to befall the person, but God will save him from every single one. But if something negative does happen, so then there has to be justice behind it. There's nothing that's out of God's control. Yes, these, I think, are a lot of the main points here. I mean, security, immortality, ambition, success, fame, social approval, accomplishment, and the fact that there's a never-ceasing drive, a reservoir, I should say, of energy that pushes a person forward. Or the person looking for the absolute security in certain things. And King Solomon tells us, no. At times it's maybe good, at times it's not a good. There's only one thing which you should be following always, and that's intelligence. Always assess the situation and use intelligence to apply it. But that is going to be only as successful as your knowledge is about human nature, because most of our activities are with other people. Right outside of learning, of course. You see, Maimonides says that a person should try to spend time in seclusion. I mean, he's really involved in thought and in gaining knowledge. And, of course, if he's educating others, that's important. But he has to be concerned about the self. Okay, any other questions? All right, so we'll resume next week. And if you want, look through it. We don't have to go in order. There's no reason to go in order here. This should be more of a summary, cleaning up the loose ends if there's other, lingering questions or things that might come up as we just, review in the book, review in our minds, what we discussed all this time. All right?
All right.
Okay, so we'll pick up next Sunday, same time, 11:15, and we'll go further.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you for taking your time to read all those articles for us, doing the research and writing them in the Jewish Times. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Have a good week, everybody.